You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 2nd of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
Russia is engaged in a rather remarkable period of the most overt and extensive propaganda exercise that I've seen since the very height of the Cold War.
Just a week after accusing Russia of lying to his face, US Secretary of State John Kerry is preparing to meet with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov today. And Australia's Deputy Prime Minister is hinting that the search for MH370 may be nearing an end.
We have committed significant financial resources to the search, and we will have to make a decision also about how much more we would be prepared to devote.
Also ahead, Qatar causes a few ripples on the international real estate landscape as it takes full ownership of the Porto Nuovo district in Milan. And later in the show, we'll head to Barcelona to see what new gadgets our tech correspondent David Phelan has found at Mobile World Congress. All that, plus the latest on the Estonian elections, the latest business news too, and plenty more besides right here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. This is The Briefing at 7:01 a.m. in New York City. A busy show in prospect. Let's have a look through the North American front pages, though, and find out what's making headlines there. I'm joined in the studio by Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor. Steve, where shall we begin today's rundown of the papers?
Hello, Tom. We're going to begin, in fact, with the New York Times. Two stories worth looking at there. Kerry pushing for agreement in nuclear talks is the main story on the right-hand side. This is as, obviously, being Benjamin Netanyahu arrives in the US to denounce negotiations, as this story by Michael R. Gordon says. So John Kerry is in Switzerland meeting again with Mohammad Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister. And obviously John Kerry's hoping those talks go well while he is away. Mr. Netanyahu will be in Washington pointing out why he's not such a fan of those talks.
And we'll be keeping an eye on what Netanyahu gets up to over the next couple of days here on the station. Where should we head next, Steve?
Also on the New York Times, on the left-hand column, Justice Report to Fault Bias by Ferguson. Years of discrimination seen in traffic stops. They've almost finished this report. The Justice Department, which is expected to be highly critical, accusing police in Ferguson, Missouri, of making discriminatory traffic stops of African-Americans that created years of racial animosity, obviously all leading up to the shooting last year of teenager Michael Brown. LA Times, a gay group now part of GOP family. Interesting story here. This is how the log cabin Republicans in California have been formally recognised as a gay group within the Republican Party. They were sort of a pressure group that were sort of trying to be in it but weren't really allowed into the fold. It's happened in California. Whether that's going to happen elsewhere, unlikely perhaps at the moment, we'll see.
And there's still, I mean, quite interesting, in 2016 presidential campaign, of course, there's same-sex marriage going to be very much one of the hot issues still, so interesting context. Perhaps one more briefly, Steve.
Finally, on the Washington Post, going back to talk about Benjamin Netanyahu, a very nice piece here by Anne Geeran in Jerusalem. Clinton and Netanyahu have a complicated history, to talk about Hillary Clinton's relationship with Netanyahu. And it starts with a lovely story about, interesting story about Hillary Clinton's phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu when she was Secretary of State. This was a phone call back in 2010, describing a 45-minute phone call during which she spoke for 43 minutes. She spoke, he listened. It points out that there are very few politicians around the world who would be lecturing Netanyahu. Normally, it's the other way around.
Indeed it is. Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor, thanks very much for looking at those headlines. Some of the newspaper stories there leading the US editions. What about some of the big business stories of the day? Let's check in with Matt Campbell from Bloomberg News. Matt, thanks for being on the programme. Good to speak with you. Let's talk about cybersecurity, first of all. We've got Mobile World Congress in Barcelona. We're going to be there later in the programme. Tell us about some of the issues that are going to be under discussion there.
Well, one of the things that is going on at the Mobile World Congress to make the point if you like, that cybersecurity is hugely important is a Czech cybersecurity firm called Avast Software is actually hacking people's phones. They're doing so in a somewhat benign way, but basically they're setting up a wireless hotspot, seeing who connects to it, and as a result, grabbing some of their data to make the point that even at this gathering of very sophisticated people in the mobile and computing industries, everyone is very lax about security when it comes to mobile devices. And this is, I think, a bit of a sleeper issue for business and for consumers. We have had little odds and ends, stories of hacking, people losing credit card data, things like that. But this is a subject that is just so top of mind for anyone who runs an IT network. And we have a company in Barcelona trying to show that we should all be paying much more attention to it.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about India, Matt, next. Narendra Modi, under a lot of pressure about the budget, but there seem to be some positive signs about whether he can turn things around.
That's right. We are seeing the process of introducing India's new budget under the new Prime Minister Modi this week. This is pretty interesting because India, after having lagged the Chinese economy for a while, actually may this year exceed China in growth. And this is partly due to reforms by the government. It's partly due to China slowing down a little bit, which makes the comparison easier. But observers do seem to think that Modi is doing all the right things, or most of the right things anyway, talking about spending on infrastructure, reducing red tape, dealing with some of the structural issues in the Indian economy that was holding it back. So if he does succeed and does manage to unlock growth in a country of more than a billion people, the results could be very dramatic for the world economy.
One to keep a very close eye on indeed, Matt. Matt Campbell from Bloomberg News, thanks very much for joining us here on The Briefing. Ticking towards 12:07 here in London. You're listening to Monocle 24. In London, we are talking next about what might be a rather tense and awkward meeting taking place today between the US Secretary of State John Kerry and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The discussions come as Moscow and Kiev are preparing to meet in Brussels over an increasingly bitter gas dispute. To tell us more, we're joined now on the line by Monocle's correspondent in Brussels, Charlotte MacDonald Gibson. Charlotte, first of all, this energy issue, the meeting today, what do we expect to be thrashed out?
Well, this latest spat over energy between Russia, Ukraine and the EU, this stems from supplies to the rebel-held part of eastern Ukraine. Last month, Kiev briefly stopped supplying this region. They said it was an issue with the pipeline. They said they resumed it again quite soon after. But Gazprom then stepped in. They started supplying these rebel-held eastern areas. And then demanded payment from Kiev, which they obviously weren't very happy about. Now, even Putin then weighed in last Wednesday, and he said that denying this region of gas supplies basically amounted to genocide. He threatened to cut off gas supplies to Ukraine. And then, of course, Gazprom came in and said, well, that will then threaten EU energy supplies. So we're back to this sort of rhetoric that we had last year, which was eventually thrashed out in a deal brokered by the EU, the winter package, which basically stated that Ukraine had to pay upfront for all Russian gas. So what the EU is going to be hoping to do today is bring all sides back to the table, calm the rhetoric down a little bit, and make sure that those terms of that winter package are going to be respected. It's only a few more weeks now that this deal is going to be valid for. It expires on March 31st. Some analysts are saying that this latest spat is jockeying for position, is a little bit of saber rattling ahead of the next round of negotiations towards the summer package. So that's what we can expect today.
And Charlotte, tell us what people are saying where you are about this prospective meeting then between Kerry and Lavrov. Is there a lot of anticipation about that? People think it might be a bit of a damp squib. What are they saying where you are?
Well, I think people are very interested in the atmosphere there, because we're seeing very mixed signals about this ceasefire on the ground in Ukraine that was agreed a couple of weeks ago. Both sides are accusing the other of violating it, but there are some signs of heavy weaponry being withdrawn by both sides. There haven't been as many deaths of servicemen over the last 24 hours. So I think they're looking for some sort of signal as to where Washington stands on this and where Moscow does. So far, the signs are not particularly good. It looked like a pretty chilly meeting when they did meet. There were no smiles for the camera or warm handshakes. The animosity really is quite high at the moment, especially after Kerry last week openly accused Moscow of lying to his face about their support for the separatists. Russia wasn't very happy with this. So that's the atmosphere in which they're meeting. Lavrov has also just addressed the UN Human Rights Council there. We're seeing a similar rhetoric from him, accusing the Ukrainians of extremists and having a humanitarian blockade of this region. But I think that, again, what the EU nations are going to be looking at more than the rhetoric is events on the ground. They say they're not going to let up any sanctions yet. They're just going to see what happens, see if the ceasefire is implemented, give it a bit more time.
Charlotte MacDonald Gibson, Monocle's correspondent in Brussels, thank you very much, as always, for joining us here on The Briefing. Exactly 11 minutes past the hour in London, 7:11 in Washington, D.C. Good morning to you if you're tuned in on the east coast of the U.S. Now, Australia's Deputy Prime Minister Warren Truss is talking down suggestions that the search for Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 may be nearing its end. As the one-year anniversary of the disappearance approaches, Truss said that while Australia remains committed to honouring the families of the missing, the search would need to end at some point.
We can't go on forever, and eventually a judgment will have to be made. Clearly we can't search all the oceans of the globe, and the area that we're talking about is vast. It's up to six days sailing time from Perth, or essentially the nearest port. So it's a difficult area to be working in. We've had four cyclones through the area in the period since the search has been undertaken.
Warren Truss there. For a little more analysis of this, I'm joined now by the Sky News Melbourne Bureau Chief, Aaron Young. Aaron, let me ask you, is this about the kind of logistics that Truss was talking about there, or are there actually political concerns which are informing this process at the moment?
Well, it might have been the first, and then the second came into the fore, because within a matter of hours from that press conference, which you just played a grab from there, which happened in Australia yesterday, they were very quick out to put a statement once the media started going through this, thinking, wow, are they really looking to wrap up the search for MH370 as we, of course, approach the one-year anniversary since it disappeared. They've put out a statement saying that absolutely they are not discussing ending the search. In fact, the only discussions which are ongoing at the moment are to continue the search. However, the areas, as they have been continuing to shift the areas over the past year where they have been searching, the current area is due to be finished up in May. That perhaps prompted him to speculate about, you know, where can this really go from here? The intelligence that they have is just so thin as to where that aircraft may be. Looking at, you know, the sort of things that we've been talking about over the past year, these pulses. And that actually was the second part of the news conference which they were talking about, which is that Australia will be joining Indonesia and Malaysia, trialling a new method, essentially tracking aircraft over remote oceanic areas. So up until now, aircraft have been putting out these pulses every 30 to 40 minutes. They now want to use the existing aircraft and technology, which is in 90% of long-haul aircraft around the world, and that will mean that they'll be able to speed that process up to every 15 minutes. A ping for where you currently are and two more pings for where you are potentially about to head.
Aaron, it's obviously very delicate politically, because there is a huge financial commitment involved in this sort of search operation. But I guess that people must be mindful of those economic considerations. Do you think it is politically quite a delicate balancing act? And how well, what's the view where you are? Do people think that Truss and his colleagues have actually been negotiating that slightly awkward path relatively well thus far?
Well, I think so. In fact, the time for discussing the cost of these things has really passed in many ways. We had this discussion probably 4 or 5 months after the aircraft first went missing, when we're looking at the amount of money that it was costing to do so. But the government's kept pointing out that given it is such a mystery and the 777 is an aircraft which is in the fleets of so many of the world's greatest airlines, that really we need to know what happened to this aircraft. And perhaps the curiosity is more important than the financial. And in terms of politically, I think that the public just want to know, particularly given that last year there were so many air disasters, of course, compared to average, involving commercial aircraft and around this region, or involving Malaysian Airlines, that being MH17, as well as the AirAsia X aircraft. The AirAsia aircraft, of course, which went down just before Christmas. But certainly the government knows that it is very expensive. The costs aren't just being borne by Australia, though. They're being borne by many others. And certainly the pressure wouldn't just be coming from Australia, but also, of course, the families. And there were many, many different nationalities on board MH370. And from the American government, from Boeing themselves, who were dispatched to be part of this too. So it's been a multinational effort, not just involving the searches, but also, of course, involving the people who are providing the intelligence behind the scenes. I think that there's a curiosity to see whether they can find the aircraft, not just about the cost of doing so.
Aaron, just one final thought. I mean, is there any sense where you are of, an end game here? You mentioned that there are these sort of stages of the investigation, additional deadlines coming by May time, or are people, is this sort of rather awkward dawning realisation that maybe this is a mystery that could endure for years, potentially forever?
Well, I think you're right on the final part, but I think that they are also looking at trying to bring a sense of confidence back to the travelling public. It wasn't a very good year last year, if you're a nervous flyer, of course, and they know that. So that's why they really have been pushing forward with this, and they're saying it's a new method of tracking that would have triggered heightened surveillance for that sort of aircraft 7 hours earlier. When it changed direction, remember, it took a long time for them to figure out that the aircraft was actually missing. And by that stage, who knows where it is, which is how they've ended up in this situation. So I think it's one part is trying to find where is this aircraft? Is it possible that, searching for it in very, very deep water is able to do it? I think it's also good in the sense that this sorts of search and doing things for the first time mean that they're able to, trial new equipment and see what they can do with the current equipment, perhaps what they need to do, but also secondly, find out where are the failings in the aviation systems. I think for Qantas, for example, the Australian airline, if they were to have a satellite tracking system on every single aircraft, the costs are $300 million a year. So what the government's announced here in Australia, as well as Indonesia too, and Malaysia, is that they're able to use existing technology, the existing pings, and just essentially speed that up from 40 minutes to every 15 minutes with the hope that if something was to happen to another aircraft, we of course still don't know what exactly led to the disappearance of MH370, but if there was to be a pilot, hypothetically, who might have turned off the transponder, it would be a lot quicker for the traffic controllers on the ground to realise that something's up.
Aaron Young, Sky News Melbourne Bureau Chief, thanks very much indeed for joining us here on the programme. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. We're heading to Estonia next to discuss political tensions following the elections there. Stay tuned.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
Ticking towards 14:19 in Tallinn, where we head next. Estonia's ruling centre-right party has won that country's general election, with Prime Minister Taavi Rõivas and his Reform Party beating the opposition and pro-Russian Centre Party. It's been an election shaped by geopolitical tensions with Russia. A fear persists in Western policymaking circles that Vladimir Putin has set his sights on destabilising the Baltics through political means, particularly given the Centre Party has a cooperation treaty with Putin's United Russia. Well, joining me now from Tallinn to talk through the results is Monocle's contributor, Lise Kengsepp, who's been covering the election for the Wall Street Journal. Lise, great to speak with you. Is it right to simply describe the opposition as pro-Kremlin? Or is it in fact true that, there are a lot of Russian speakers within the country who merely want sort of friendlier relations with Moscow, and it's not about Putin necessarily? Is that how you would characterise things?
I wouldn't say it's necessarily pro-Kremlin or about Putin. 75% of the voters who vote for Centre Party, yes, they are native Russian speakers, and partly because Centre Party for years has been the only party who has actually dealt with the Russian language population and offering them something to go with. So Edgar Savisaar, the leader of the Centre Party, is a very, very popular figure, especially among the native Russian speakers who live in Estonia. I wouldn't necessarily say that Centre Party is pro-Kremlin. I think they're just maybe more orientated towards promising more to the Russian-speaking population who lives in Estonia. That makes up 25% of our population.
Indeed, interesting numbers, Lisa. I just wonder, do you think it's unhelpful then to characterise this election as being about, you know, the geopolitics, as being about the relationship with Russia? There were other issues that were featured in the run-up. People talked, of course, about the economy. They talked about taxes and wages, raising the minimum wage, more progressive tax models. Do you think that those were still relevant issues, or was it hard to look beyond what was happening in terms of what's going on in Russia at the moment?
Well, you know, the security issues actually were not so widely debated about, because most of the parties, they agreed on very big issues when it comes to security. So they all agreed that we need to increase maybe the defense budget and think more about soft power and think more about how we can feel securer in our region, considering what is going on in the world at the moment. So what they were more debated about were maybe tax issues and the issues of how to raise wages in Estonia, which are still, compared to the Western European countries, quite low.
And Lisa, tell us a little bit about the idea then of these, I guess, populist, you know, newer populist parties who've done relatively well. They're in parliament for the first time, some of them, the People's Party of Estonia, the Estonian Free Party. Are there any causes for concerns given that trend? We've seen a lot of increasingly populist rhetoric throughout, you know, Europe and the wider space. Or is that just something that sits fairly comfortably in the sort of political landscape there?
In this respect, these elections have been very, very interesting, because it's been a while since we've seen more than four parties in the parliament. So now we have six parties in the parliament instead of four. And those newcomers, they may be a little bit populist, but compared to Western European radical parties, they are still quite mild when it comes to different issues. Yes, the Conservative People's Party is anti-immigration, and they recently held a march in Estonia, or in Tallinn, saying that for Estonians, Estonia, which means that they are not keen on getting immigrants to move to Estonia. And when it comes to the Estonian Free Party, then I think many people haven't really understand what they are about. And one of the reasons why they got so many votes is that people are tired of the current political leadership, and they just want to see change. And you can see it from the election results as well, because all of the biggest, all the three bigger parties except the Centre Party, they lost seats in the parliament. Considerably, the Pro Patria and Respublica Union that lost 9 seats in the parliament, and we have only 101 seats in Estonian parliament. So their loss was very big.
At least one final thought then. Looking at the ruling party then, a lot of talk about, you know, destabilisation, the idea that Russia could be trying to sort of politically make its influence felt. Stability ahead? How would you characterise what we're going to see over the next, I don't know, few months or so?
Well, I think the next few months we're going to see a new government. We are going to see a government that is formed by three parties instead of two, because the two biggest parties, Estonian Reform Party and the Centre Party, they are not going to work together, because the Reform Party has said that they absolutely refuse to go to the government with a party that has a cooperation contract with Putin's party in Russia. To be quite honest, it's like when we hear about these things that the Western leaders now are saying more and more that Baltic states could be the next in line, it is not something that makes people in Estonia nervous so much, because we've heard these lines quite many times over the last year. So I think kind of this new security situation has become our normal. Has become a normal situation for us, so we don't think about it every day.
Indeed. There we must leave it. Elise Kangsepp, speaking to us from Estonia, thanks very much for being on The Briefing. 24 minutes past the hour in London, 13:24 in Barcelona, where tens of thousands of industry insiders, analysts and journalists have flocked to attend the world's largest mobile fair. We discussed a little earlier in our business roundup, the Mobile World Congress officially kicks off today. Monocle's technology correspondent David Phelan, of course he's there. So what big products are on the way and what exciting new toys has David found? David, great to speak with you as ever. Tell us, what are the things, what's everyone talking about over in Barcelona at the moment?
I think the biggest news, unsurprisingly, is the phone, or rather the two phones that Samsung has launched, the Samsung Galaxy S6 and S6 Edge. Samsung knew they had to really pull something out of the bag this year because they were losing sales on their previous year's flagship, and they've come up with a really impressive design, and they had a very bullish, excited presentation last night, which absolutely took the battle directly to Apple, comparing their camera to the iPhone camera and saying how much better theirs was and so on, and introducing lots of innovative features.
I mean, it's interesting, David, we talked before about this marketplace. There is this factor that, you know, if handsets are sort of running similar operating systems, if they're, say, an Android phone, you know, it is important to stand out, and design becomes the new battleground. In terms of the design side of things, though, does that also measure up? Some tough talking, but you think on the design side, these things will deliver?
Yes. The S6 Edge has a curious wraparound screen that curves, slopes down on the long edges of the phone, and it's strikingly different. You can't mistake it for any other phone. Now, it has functionality to it as well. It lights up in certain ways so that you can see your boss is calling you even if the phone is face down on the table. But they have absolutely gone for a really premium design that looks like nothing else on the market and really looks great, I have to say.
Now, what other things are up for discussion, David? I mean, people talking about security. We've always talked about 2015 being maybe like, you know, the year of wearables, this kind of tech. Any other sort of themes that you think people will be taking away from this year's event?
Sure. There have been a couple of smartwatches announced. You kind of think, well, is this the right time to launch a smartwatch? There haven't been that many. Only 700,000 Android Wear watches have been sold in the last year. That's the one using the Google platform. Apple is reportedly ordering 6 million of its smartwatch, the Apple Watch, that launches in April. So that hasn't been as big a thing as it might have been expected, but security has certainly been. Samsung, again, have launched Samsung Pay, which will allow you, as you can with the iPhone in America, to pay using your phone. They have a different system, which is, they say, much more widely used. You can even use it on chip and pin units that don't have contactless features. It mimics the magnetic stripe on a credit card. And that's coming to the States and Korea in the summer. And the president of Samsung UK has just told me that they hope to have it in the UK and Europe by the end of the year. So that's been, I think, a very big story.
Exciting developments, as always. From Barcelona, Monocle's technology correspondent David Phelan. Thanks for joining us here on The Briefing. Nearly at the end of today's show, but before we go, a transaction worth about 2 billion euros means that the Qatar Sovereign Wealth Fund has taken full ownership of the Milan district of Porta Nuova. The move is being billed as proof that Italy can compete on the global stage in attracting international capital. But what do Italians think of this? Well, let's hear from Monocle's correspondent in the city of Milan right now, Ivan Carvalho. Ivan, what has been the reaction where you are?
Well, it is some good news because we see an injection of capital into a project that has, for the most part, been completed and has been a success. Whereas in past master plans and projects around Milan, we've had various problems with investigations about with mafia or because of the credit crisis. And this one has gone through and they've made a sale.
And now, Ivan, tell us a little bit about Porta Nuova. I mean, what exactly is involved here? It's a big property development. What does the area, you know, represent? What exactly are the Qataris involved with here?
Well, what it is taking what was mostly part of the railways yard in Milan. So it's not as if they were taking out neighborhoods, old neighborhoods. There was a few areas, some workshops and part of the Isola neighborhood. But for the most part, they were taking an old part of the railway, and there's still areas to invest. There's also other railway disused parts in Milan. And this area has been completed with, there's a new headquarters for UniCredit, the big Italian bank. We have shops. We have lots of luxury apartments. They're about 65% sold, these luxury apartments, where you now see there's a Michelin star restaurant has opened. There's going to be a park, which they're completing in the near future. So it's become a new hub for downtown Milan.
And Ivan, just fairly briefly, I mean, does this then herald a greater influx then of foreign capital into the country? We've seen other investments from the Gulf, particularly talking about airlines, into sports franchises, this kind of thing. More to come, do you think?
Definitely. With Italy in need of cash and cash-rich countries or regions or individuals out there looking to invest, as you mentioned, with the football clubs, one of the Milan football clubs, Inter Milan, is now owned by an Indonesian businessman, and Silvio Berlusconi, who owns AC Milan, has said that he would look at offers if there's a billion euros out there that somebody wants to give him. So you are seeing interest from the Gulf states. The Qataris also own a hotel that just recently reopened next to Milan's central train station. So I think this is the beginning of more foreign capital coming in to the country.
Ivan Carvalho in Milan, thanks very much indeed for joining us here on the programme. That's all for this edition of The Briefing here in London. Thanks to our producer Ben Ryland, our researchers Guy Lutz and Lara Kunze and Mike Hun, our studio manager Bill Lutie. For the next hour, Steve Bloomfield will be bringing you the Continental Shift, so stay tuned.